Just days after President Obama made public his decision to begin arming Syrian rebel groups fighting to overthrow the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the G8 summit meeting in Northern Ireland issued a declaration calling for a negotiated and peaceful end to the 2-year civil war, which has claimed more than 93,000 lives. In deference to Russia's refusal to back any declaration that makes Assad's removal from power an explicit goal, the G8 urged peace talks being planned in Geneva to reach a settlement that will produce a coalition government with a top leadership that inspires public confidence. Many observers believe that the White House decision to arm the rebels was not, as announced, linked to a determination that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons, but rather a reaction to the recent losses by opposition forces in key battles against Assad's troops, such as in Qusair. However it began 2 years ago, the war in Syria has in many ways been transformed into a proxy battle between the region's Sunni and Shia governments, with Sunni-majority Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey backing the rebels, against Shia-dominated Iran and Hezbollah supporting the Syrian regime controlled by the Shia offshoot Alawite sect. The involvement of the European Union and the U.S. on the rebel side, and Russia's support for the government, has made the Syrian conflict a very real threat to regional stability, with violence now spreading to Syria's neighbors. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, who warns that President Obama's decision to arm Syrian rebel groups will inevitably lead to a tragic escalation of that nation's brutal civil war.
The problem that we face, Scott, is that all of this is grounded on the absolutely false illusion that there is somehow a military solution to this problem. And that's clearly not the case. What needs to happen is real negotiations. The U.S.-Russian talks about talks seem to have some possibility. There was a little bit of optimism in there. But at this point, both the U.S. and the Russians have pulled back from their earlier commitments, and they're both talking about more and bigger and stronger and greater arms for their respective sides. We're also seeing in the region a hardening of positions. The Iran position that they're threatening, it's not at all clear this is true, but even making the threat becomes a political act in itself, that they might send troops to fight in Syria on the part of the Syrian government. The refusal of the Iraqi government, which is of course also allied with Iran and Syria, and the leader, al-Maliki, the prime minister, despite his complete dependence on the United States, has felt absolutely willing to say, we have no intention of ending the Iranian flights over Iraqi airspace to deliver weapons and who knows what else to Syria. So that side is consolidating its militarization. President Obama has recently said that he's prepared to provide direct military support. It could mean a no-fly zone. It could mean arming the rebels. It could mean something else. The Egyptian government has withdrawn their ambassador from Damascus and has made clear that they now stand firmly on the side of the rebels against the regime. Turkey has made a very strong statement in favor of the rebels. They've been supporting them all along anyway. So we see this divide within the Middle East, that you now have a regional struggle going on. There's a sectarian struggle going on between Sunni and Shia, with the so-called Sunni crescent of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Egypt on the one hand, and the Shia crescent of Syria, Iraq, and Iran on the other hand. So you have a sectarian war. You have the global war between the U.S. and Russia over things like their naval bases in Bahrain for the U.S. and Tartus in Syria for the Russians. And at the end of the day, all of these outside actors are prepared to fight to the last Syrian. So the Syrian people are the ones that are going to pay the biggest price. The toughest fighters against the regime right now are those from the so-called al-Nusra Front, a hardline Islamist organization that the U.S. has indicated is what they call a terrorist organization, not to be dealt with, not to be talked to, not to be certainly armed or supported. And yet they are the only really good fighters in the rebel coalition. And the secular, pro-Western, so-called good guys that the U.S. wants to have more power, wants to arm, etc., have been very public that we may not like these guys, but they're the ones who know how to fight, so we fight shoulder to shoulder with them. So this U.S. view that somehow we can provide weapons to our choice of good guys and they won't fall into the hands of the, quote, bad guys is simply nonsense. It's absolutely a spurious claim.
Just a final question for you. In terms of civil society, Phyllis, what would you advocate in terms of a new U.S. policy that wouldn't fuel this war to ever greater escalation, but to reduce the violence?
We have to start from the vantage point that there is no military solution. So the first thing is stop sending more weapons. Engage seriously in diplomatic talks. The U.S. must stop its nonsense of saying, we'll talk to the Russians, but we won't allow Iran to be present. Because what that says then is Iran doesn't have any skin in the game. There's no reason for them to abide by any agreement reached because they've been excluded from the process. This is something that we learned from former Senator George Mitchell when he was heading up the Good Friday Accord negotiations in Ireland, where he said very clearly, if you're serious about your diplomacy, that's the key. If you're serious, everybody has to be at the table, because if they're not, it's not going to work. It doesn't matter whether you like them or not, but if you exclude someone because you think they're terrorists, you're giving them every reason to ignore whatever agreement finally emerges. There then needs to be a UN mandate that the Russians hopefully will be able to persuade the Syrian government and the U.S. will be able to persuade the rebels to accept a weapons of mass destruction / chemical weapons inspection team with a serious mandate to investigate all allegations on all sides. So far, the two sides are basically saying, we'll only accept a mandate that's narrow enough to only go after the other guys. And that means that there won't ever be a serious inspection, and there should be. The final thing I would say is that we have to keep in mind longer-term issues. It's not enough to just say we're going to stop it right this second, knowing it could explode again. That means we should be pushing again for the creation of a weapons of mass destruction free zone throughout the Middle East. This is something, of course, Scott, you'll remember that this was the language that was used in the resolution that ended the Gulf War back in 1991. The U.S. drafted that resolution. It's about time they did something to enforce it.
That was Phyllis Menes, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of many books, including Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org for more news and commentary on Syria's civil war.